from the results of our review, and here we're talking about the MRF division of FARA. On the left, we show the summary of the 2010 valuation results prepared by the fund actuary. In this case, we're comparing, looking at the unfunded accrued liabilities, about $442 million, and then also looking at statutory contributions compared to actuarially required contributions. Item B details the total statutory contributions, and that's $28.6 million. Item C4 totals the actuarially required contributions, which in most part is payment of the unfunded liability. And the total actuarially required contributions are about $47.8 million, which leads to a contribution deficiency in this fund of about $19.2 million. That level of deficiency leads us to make comments in our report that this fund is in a seriously deficient position. While that would be ordinarily item of concern, we do want to point out that the valuation process doesn't take into account two different changes that have already been made with respect to this fund. Starting in the fiscal year after June 30, 2012, there are additional sources of funding that go into the fund, increased state contributions and increases to the additional employer contributions. And then in addition, there's an additional test where more employer contributions are required if there's a solvency concern in the fund. So if the fund gets into a position where it doesn't have enough money to pay benefits, then additional employer contributions are required. And then over the longer term, there is a mechanism that's triggered that would merge the MRF into the PERA general fund if the funding reaches 80%. And then when that happens, the different Minneapolis employer units are required to pay any unfunded liability over a scheduled period of time at that point. So if you're looking just solely at the 2010 valuation results, you would get the impression that there's some pretty serious concerns here, given the changes that are going to be coming down the road in a couple of years or potentially thereafter, depending on the funded status, gives us a certain assurance that over the long term, the fund should be pretty well taken care of.
So would you say that the future changes that are on the books here, and as you've noted in this printout, are going to do the job sufficiently to get us out of this seriously deficient status?
Mr. Chairman, I would say that it would be prudent to take a wait-and-see approach.
Okay.
To see how the results bear out over the next several years.
Okay, so it's a question that's still out there then.
From a policy perspective, I would think that no action is required at this time.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
I think it's also important to note, because we're here on a state level, that as the law is currently written, that if there is some unfunded accrued liability as of the date of the merger, it is the Minneapolis employing units that make up that. So to the state, once those fixed contributions were set in statute, any remaining costs, so to the state, it is less of a risk. I think this is a question that Minneapolis employing units will greatly be interested in, more so, but I think without having all of these numbers factored in, these are big changes to this situation. So I would agree that at this time, in this situation, we on the state level can certainly wait.
You may proceed.
Mr. Chairman. Continuing on to page 15, we have a few specific comments with respect to the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund. First one is that the fund actuary, we believe, should modify the valuation of active members to consider all statutory benefits. For this fund, we did a limited scope review. We did not do a full replication valuation, so we are not able to offer an opinion about what the real effect is of this. given that in this situation, what is being done is one set of benefit provisions is being reflected, but the possibility that a member might be eligible for a different set of benefit provisions, it was not being reflected. So at a minimum, we expect liabilities will be increased if this is reflected, but we can't offer an opinion as far as how much of an impact that's going to have on the results for the Duluth Teachers Fund. Second item of note is that this is a mature fund. The 2010 valuation did reflect a solvency test, so there was a 10-year projection that was done, and that projection reflected the fact that there were sufficient resources to pay benefits and expenses over that 10-year projection period. So despite this fund being a very mature fund, over the next 10 years, there are sufficient monies expected to pay benefits. The last item to note in this fund is that there are significant asset losses yet to be recognized. So as these asset losses are recognized over future years, we do expect the actual required contribution rate to increase, and so the deficiency measure will also increase in future valuations.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Herman, would you explain a little further how you think that the active members will have more benefits, or some members would have more benefits?
Mr. Herman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, within the Duluth Teachers Fund, there are members that are eligible for Tier 1 benefits and Tier 2 benefits. The Tier 1 members get the better of Tier 1 or Tier 2 when they retire. Depending on their individual salary and service, what's more valuable changes depending on the age at which that member retires. So some ages it's more valuable under Tier 1, other ages it's more valuable under Tier 2, and the fund actuary was not considering the Tier 2 benefits in the Tier 1 members' valuations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
May I proceed?
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, on page 16, we've laid out a informational slide which shows on the replication work that we did for Para General and MSRS General employees, the impacts of using a beginning of the year assumed date of decrement versus a middle of the year assumed date of decrement. Now, what I mean by that is in evaluation, actuarial valuation, we have all kinds of assumptions relative to members leaving employment. They may leave because they elect to leave and go to a new job, or they retire, or if there's death or disability. But in those situations, in general, we believe that it is best to assume on average that the population leaves during the middle of the year of the valuation year that we're doing. And because on average, then you'll have some people leaving earlier in the year, some people leaving later in the year, and on average, it would work out to about middle of the year. In those funds, currently the valuation is being done, was being done at beginning of the year. So we wanted to evaluate what the difference was in terms of doing a decrement between beginning of the year and middle of the year, since we were replicating the actuary's work. And so you can see here what those differences are. And in general, I would point out, it's not on the slide here, but the overall present value of benefits was not really impacted much at all. very little change depending on which decrement you use. But the difference occurs, or the impacts occur, with respect to how those costs are allocated between past service and future service. The accrued liability represents the liability to date based on the funding method for years of service worked in the past. The normal cost reflects the current year cost accrual for expected service, and so it's more of a future service component. And you can see that from our work, the normal cost generally increases when going from beginning of the year to middle of the year decrement. The increase was much more pronounced for MSRS General than it was for PERA. And the amortization, that's one component of the cost of when we calculate contribution deficiency sufficiency. The other component is the relationship of accrued liability to assets, and the amount of that difference that's unfunded gets amortized under the funding method, so it gets paid off over a period of years. And the accrued liability, or the past service component, went down. For PERA General, that it dropped fairly significantly, about 47 points. But for MSRS General, the drop was not quite as much, about 31 points. So the net impact, when you look at the total annual cost, actuarial cost, was a decrease for PERA General because the amortization component, the past service component, dropped more than the normal cost went up. While in MSRS, the change actually increases the cost because the normal cost goes up much more than the amortization of the unfunded accrued liability. So the total results are somewhat mixed, but the net impact is definitely in the direction of increasing normal cost and reducing the amortization of unfunded past service costs. In discussing this with Mr. Martin, one of the things that he suggested we would ask the Legislative Commission to consider is, with the current set of valuations, we've received a request from the actuary for these funds to consider allowing another year of beginning of the year valuations. The actuarial standards call for middle of the year valuations as they're written, and so based on the request from the fund actuary, we'd like direction from the commission as to our review process as to how you would like us to approach our review of that, and also whether or not you can give guidance to the fund actuary as to whether or not you'll accept their valuation as of beginning of the year. In the letter, they cite a few of the issues that they face. One of the issues is that they didn't feel like the change was necessarily a definitive change in terms of the overall cost, because one fund goes one way, the other fund goes the other way. And also, in this instance, the actuary, the firm is Mercer, and the actuary is in their last year and will not continue services in the future, as that firm is discontinuing providing services to governmental employers, or at least that's our understanding that they're doing. And so, with those reasons, I guess I put that request out in front of you and request any guidance you might offer us or how we might proceed.
Mr. Martin, do you want to speak to that?
Members, the Pension Commission has been required to develop things called standards for actuarial work, was a result of the 1984 legislature and changes in the way that actuarial services were arranged at that time. And the commission produced standards in 1985 and has updated them periodically. A year or so ago, we had our reviewing actuary review the standards for actuarial work, and the commission heard the recommendations of Milliman on reviewing or on updating the standards, and they were updated about a year ago. The standards have required this mid-year recognition of decrement items for some period of time now. I'm not sure if it was the original standards or developed somewhere over the period 1985 to date, but this has been part of the standards for some period of time. The commission did authorize Mercer to use the start of the year rather than mid-year last year under the theory that there should be continuity in results. I think is the principal argument. We now have some valuation of what the difference is between beginning of the year and mid-year. Presumably, when a new actuary in a year takes over the actuarial work for the plans that Mercer currently does, presumably they're going to follow the standards and start doing mid-year decrement work. So it's really a question whether we want one additional year of actuarial work that's not totally in compliance with the standards. I didn't feel comfortable having our consultant be involved in giving the final judgment as to whether that authorization should occur, and I didn't feel it was appropriate for our staff to do it either. So that's why I've suggested that the question be referred to you. Should you authorize Mercer or all of the PERA? I'm looking at the sheet plans to continue not recognizing this feature of the standards for actuarial work. At this stage, I believe representatives of Mercer are here, and we have the fund administrators for PERA and MSRS, and they may wish to make some comments. Presumably, if you do nothing, then the request is not honored, so you would have to do some formal approval, some proactive approval of the request in
so
order
it's
to
a Mercer request then.
Yes, it's a request from the Mercer actuarial firm, the actuaries for the various PERA plans and the various MSRS plans. So maybe if Milliman is done with their presentation, I think we have one or two more slides. But at the conclusion of their presentation, it may be appropriate to hear.
Well, let's come back to that then. Do you want to finish up your presentation? And we've noted your request for clarification here. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. One of the other items that we noted in our report that we will hopefully be working with the fund actuaries is the calculation of one of the ratios that are routinely provided as one of the informational items in their reports is a projected benefit ratio. And this projected benefit ratio is a projection including all years of service in the benefits for participants as to what the present value of those benefits would be relative to the expected assets, including past assets that are in the fund currently, plus future contributions expected to be received by the fund. So it's kind of a overall assessment of the funded status of where the funds would be at if they got all their contributions they're expected to get, plus if they received or they paid out all the expected benefits based on the service employees are expected to earn in the future. And the difference comes in where in some instances, particularly this year, where some of the new contribution rates are staggered and they don't all take effect in the current year, where increases in member and employer rates. In some cases, those increases are not reflected in this ratio, and in other cases, they are. And so we just noted in our report that for purposes of consistency, so when you're reading the numbers and seeing what has been produced, you'll be seeing the same calculation from all funds. And so that will be one of our recommendations to the fund actuaries to prepare. As far as other actuarial standards of practice, we've indicated that the American Academy has issued some other items. These are not in the actuarial standards for the Legislative Commission, but we think some of them are good items that should be reflected, and we made comments in our report concerning things like the identifying what the actuary should consider, document, and disclose for an actuarial assignment, assures public that actuaries are professionally accounted before, and provides actuaries with the basis to assure work conforms to appropriate practice. So we want to try and stick to the Academy of Actuaries standards where we can, and that's why we make comments relative to the American Academy of Actuaries and their actuarial standards. And then it also speaks to also improving the disclosure of certain assumptions and methods. And we don't, there were some things that we noted in our report that those disclosures might help and aid in the report in understanding what was done on the assumptions. So minor details where, once again, it gets back to our effort to, does it affect the calculation of the numbers? No. Are the results good? Yes. But ways in which to improve the work product that you're receiving, so it improves the understanding and the ability to work with what you're getting. And at that point, then, that concludes our formal presentation, and we would be happy to answer any other questions that the commission members may have, or yourself, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a couple clarifications here. On the page 13, it talked about the Actuarial Standards Board, and in particular to the mortality improvement, those changes that we had a discussion on earlier. So going back to your back page, Actuarial Standards of Practice, is this a little bit broader scope than what the mortality table might be? Would this be the sort of thing that would be automatically included in your work that you would take on that doesn't need an action by the Pension Commission or the Minnesota Legislature? Because I think those assumptions and methods are very, very important. For example, if you're going to do a budget on how much gas you need next month for the family, if the car gets the same 30 miles per gallon, if the gas price stays the same, and if you drive the same number of miles, those assumptions stay. You can make certain projections in regards to that, no matter how you do the math. Those valuation results will be the same. But if you know you're going to buy a new car and gas mileage might change, you're anticipating gas prices go up, kids have a lot of activities, you're going to drive more miles, that all of a sudden throws that projection off. And those underlying assumptions and those things and how you do that are really important. But the bigger question is, are these actuarial standards of practice going to be something that you do as a part of your firm's business, or is this something that we in Minnesota need to take an action on?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kiffmeyer, it's a very good question, and it gets back to what we do as actuaries primarily. If the members would turn back to one of the earliest pages, page 3, and if you look at the staffing, you'll notice that the majority of the individuals listed have initials MAAA, which I kind of glossed over, and I apologize for that in my earlier talking of the staffing. That stands for Member of the American Academy of Actuaries, and so all of those individuals are members of the Academy, and many of the actuaries, if not most of or all of them, that do the work are members of the Academy. And as being a member of the Academy, you are prescribing to follow the guidelines of what the Academy stands for and produces. So in certain cases, there are things in these actuarial standards that we are, as members of the Academy, are saying that we comply with. And in cases like with the mortality where you don't necessarily agree with exactly what the standard calls for, that doesn't obligate the actuary to follow that standard necessarily, but they need to disclose why they deviated from the standard and why it's reasonable. And in our cases here at the back on the last page, some of these things, I wouldn't classify some of these, or most of these things, I wouldn't classify as major deficiencies. Simply additional items that as a person who's not trying to duplicate the work maybe wouldn't notice, but in our spot where we're trying to do things and duplicate what's been done, and we look at the assumptions or the methods, there might be a small item that we have a question about and it's not contained in there, and so it wasn't a problem for us to find that out by contacting the fund actuary, but that gives rise to our comment that that item could be disclosed in the report, and then we wouldn't have to do that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If there are no further questions, thank you very much for your presentation. And I understand that there are representatives from Mercer here that wish to address us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the Commission.
Thank you. Welcome to the Commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Commission. I am Bonnie Wurst, and I'm with Mercer. And we are underway with preparing the 2011 valuations for the Minnesota State Retirement System and Public Employees Retirement Association, and appreciate your consideration of our request regarding decrement timing. I understand that a copy of the letter is available to you. I simply wanted to start by saying that we are making this request for a relatively simple reason, and that is because our valuation software does not allow for mid-year decrement timing, which is the preferred timing that's stated in the standards. And so we did work through the issue last year with Larry Martin and with the Commission's actuary to discuss and be transparent about that, and to, as Mr. Martin said, get a one-year exception to the preferred timing for last year's valuations, allowing time for those replication valuations to be done to quantify the difference, to quantify the impact of the timing. So here we are at 2011, and what I know now is that Mercer will perform the 2011 valuations, but some other firm will be doing the valuations after that. So we are asking for your consideration to use the same methodology that we used last year, which is beginning of your decrement timing. However, we understand that it's your discretion, and if you want us and don't provide that exception, we will find a way to use the mid-year decrement timing, and we will be transparent throughout. So we submit the request, and we, I'm happy to answer questions about it. But it basically it goes back to something that you wish you wouldn't have to talk about in 2011, and that's really limitations of technology.
Questions from the Commission. So you're, in effect, requesting an exception to our standards that are established?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I think it's risky for us to do that. What's your thinking?
Sure. Should we hear from a couple of funds real quick?
Sure. Let's have some of the fund representatives come forward and speak to this?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Bergstrom.
My name is Dave Bergstrom. I'm the director of the state retirement system, and we would support Mercer's request for a one-year extension. It is the last year we will be using them. If you look at the results in the report, they came out very close to what Milliman did. You know, granted, they may have credited the normal costs differently than the accrued liabilities, but the net result was very close and within very reasonable tolerance levels. We will make it clear in the request for proposal that we're going out that the next valuation, the next company that we have, will require mid-year decrement. But we just don't, because I don't believe it's necessary to make Mercer go through some programming changes for a contract that's due to expire, and it might delay receipt of our report or valuation. So we would like to see their request extended.
Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair, members, Mary Vanek, para director. I echo Mr. Bergstrom's request. Understand that in our next RFP, we will make it absolutely clear on what the standards require and that it is a necessary part of the programming that going forward. But it will, I would expect, delay receipt of our reports, and that creates additional problems. So we ask your indulgence for this one more year.
Any further questions from the commission? Ms. Martin, do you have further comment on this?
Members, I think I've laid out the issue. It's not probably something that staff ought to be making. It's something that this body make, and that's why I wanted it to be presented to you.
Sure. Senator Pogavala.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to wait to read the letter, but I'm kind of inclined to just... it doesn't sound like it's going to make a material difference, and it looks like it creates additional work for the funds.
Mr. Chairman, I just...
Representative Mark.
I'm not quite sure what the negatives would be in this regard to doing this, and I think just that a decision needs to be made. If it's one thing, if we were going to be continuing with Mercer, then we'd make this change, we'd be done with. But I think I'm also sensitive to the plan directors getting the information, especially with the legislative session coming up and some other things. I think that might be helpful, and so I'd be willing to make the motion if you're just looking for a motion.
Motion is in order.
I would move that we allow another year of beginning of the year decrement.
Can we grant the...
Grant the request.
Grant the request. Further discussion?
Mr.
Senator Pogavala.
Do we care if Milliman cares?
They're here.
Yes, Mr. we do.
They're here.
Mr. Hogan.
Yes.
Good question, Senator. Mr. Hogan?
Mr. Chairman, members
You've heard
of
the question.
As I look at it, we've quantified what we think the impact is. So I think for a temporary basis, we could probably estimate from our end, if the commission wanted to know what the impact was again this year, using similar changes to let the commission know what we think of a mid-year decrement might do to the numbers that you get from the fund actuary. So I guess I wouldn't have huge concerns about it if it's going for another year, as long as, you know, knowing that it's going to get to mid-year at some point.
So you could give us a reasonable result, even though they didn't go through that mid-year?
Yeah, I think it would be reasonable to look at the changes our numbers produced and apply those to what they get, and that would probably be a representative estimate of the impact.
Okay. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
If we don't approve the motion, then are we telling MSRS and PERA that they can't work with Mercer?
No, I don't believe that. It's just what the implications, as I understand it, would be that they might be delayed in getting what they need. Mr. Bergstrom?
Mr. Chair, delayed in requiring Mercer to do programming, which would then require probably more testing of our staff to make sure the information is correct. And when you look at on a contribution rate, Mercer's evaluation showed a 0.99% efficiency, and Milliman's mid-year showed a 0.91% efficiency, which is very, very close. We're not talking a major difference here. And, you know, just I think it adds a delay and a potential sort of extra cross-checking to make it for a one-year change. And I would agree if it was going to be a two- or three-year process, it's different. But it's very clear that Mercer won't be our actuary next year, and we are going out to bid.
I appreciate the folks from Milliman calling this to our attention. I appreciate Mr. Martin's saying that this is really a decision ought to be made here at the commission, and I'm comfortable with this motion if the commission is so inclined. All in favor of the
aye.
Motion? Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you all very much. And
thank you.
We will now move to the last item on the agenda for today. And we have some folks that will want to testify on this as well, I believe. Mr. Burrick? Mr. Burrick, you may proceed with your presentation on recently established hybrid retirement plans in other states, something that we as a commission were interested in hearing more about.
Members, I don't have too much to say on this. At our last meeting, you were presented by the major retirement plan systems with their retirement plan design study. And in the study, they had mentioned several states, including the federal government, that were using a hybrid plan, and they listed those states. What I did here was I tried to find out more information about the specific plans that that were mentioned in the in that report. Let me provide a few technical corrections and general overview comments. I don't want to cover everything in detail because you can certainly read through these charts. Let me begin by saying that the states that are reviewed here, the state plans that are reviewed here and the federal plan, also, they present a range of alternatives. Each of these has a hybrid plan, and by hybrid plan, what we mean is a scaled-down defined benefit plan offering fairly modest benefits in general, although some are not that modest, coupled with a defined contribution plan so that individuals covered by this have partial defined benefit plan coverage, partial defined contribution plan coverage. But some of these states also offered other options. For instance, the Utah retirement systems, there's information here beginning on page 7, they offer a hybrid plan, which is, again, part defined benefit, part defined contribution. And if employers, if the employee does not want that, the employee can elect a pure defined contribution plan. The Washington State offers, and this is beginning on page 8, they offer their employees a choice between a combination plan, which has a defined benefit component and a defined contribution component, or, if the employee wants it, a pure defined benefit plan. And the most complicated of the offerings is by the state of Ohio. And this begins on the bottom of page 3 and goes on to pages 4 and 5. And let me make a few detailed comments on this one, in large part because Ms. Hacking, who is the executive director of TRA, previously was the director of the Ohio Public Employees Plans, and knew quite a bit about these, and caught some areas where I had made a few technical goofs and a few oversimplifications. So let me cover those to make sure that the information is clear. On the top of page 4, the Ohio plan, there's the column that says member-directed plan. And the eligible group there, it says the Ohio public employees who elect to be covered by the defined benefit plan, that should be defined contribution plan. So that's error number one. Second, I want to provide a little more clarification on the employer contribution rates to that member-directed plan. It says there 8.5%, and then in brackets, an additional 5.5% is deposited in a health care savings account for these individuals. Basically, if you look across at all those plans, and the first plan there is what they call the traditional plan. And the traditional plan is a pure defined benefit plan. And the employee contribution to that traditional plan is 10%. The employer is 14%, which is a hefty overall contribution, 24% combined. However, I would point out that this is a basic plan. Ohio is not coordinated with Social Security, so their benefits are higher to compensate for the fact that individuals don't have Social Security coverage as a result of this employment.
Representative Pound.
Can I ask a question on that? Because they don't have Social Security coverage, what happens to their Medicare coverage?
Members, I don't claim to be an expert on this, but I believe everybody pays into that system at this point.
Since
1986. So they are covered for Medicare purposes, but not for purposes of old age, Social Security old age program. Okay. Getting back to the employee-employer contributions, under the member-directed plan, and that is a pure defined contribution plan, Ms. Hacking felt it was important to point out that the total contribution here is 14%. When you combine both the 8.5% that's actually going into this member-directed plan and 5.5% that's going into the health care account. Basically, what the state is trying to do is, regardless of whatever plan the individual elects, the employer is contributing 14% overall, either directly to the pension plan or in combination to the pension plan and for some additional health care coverage. Regarding the employer contribution for the defined benefit component of the combination plan, I had said the amount is unclear. It may be determined by the actuary. Ms. Hacking has indicated that the contribution rate to that plan is 14%. So again, it's 14% consistently. And with these Ohio plans, I should make it clear that the individual has three options. They could select the traditional plan, which is a pure defined benefit plan, its entirety, or the member can decide to be covered by the member-directed plan, which is a pure defined contribution plan, or the employee can decide that the combination plan would be best for him or her. And that combination plan is a scaled-down defined benefit plan coupled with a defined contribution plan. And one further clarification here on vesting. Under the member-directed plan, the employee contributions, since this is a defined contribution plan, the employee contributions, and presumably investment earnings on it, vest immediately. So regardless of how long you're in the plan or how briefly you're in the plan, when you leave, you would be able to claim your employee contributions and earnings. The vesting that is referred to in the chart here, 20% vested 1 year, 40% 2 years, refers to the employer contribution component only. And as long as I'm here, I might as well mention the benefit increases. And that's a little bit further than halfway down. This is this line we're talking about benefit increases for retirement annuities, but it's similar for any death annuity, survivor benefit, whatever. Basically, what Ohio is providing under the defined benefit plans is a 3% annual increase, but it does not compound. It's kind of odd in that they compute the increase on your initial benefit. So if, an example Ms. Hacking and I were using, if the individual is initially getting $1,000, then the next year they would get a 3% increase, so they would get $1,030. And then the year after that, they would get $1,060, and the year after, $1,090. So it goes up by 3%, or in this case, an example I gave, $30 each year. So it is not compounded. And a problem with this approach is that because it isn't compounded, people are falling further and further behind with inflation. Ms. Hagging indicated that in practice what has happened with this plan is that you have this 3% annual increase without compounding, but because the retirees are getting way behind on inflation, periodically the legislature has decided to offer ad hoc increases in addition to this automatic increase. Having made those specific comments about the Ohio plan, let me move back to some general overview comments.
Say, before you move on, do we have any information about having all these options, what their experience has been in terms of how many employees are signing up for one or the other, what the reasons for it might be?
What Ms. Hagging did mention, and I'm sure she can provide additional benefits on this, additional information on this, but she did mention that with Ohio, which offers the traditional plan, the member-directed defined contribution, or this combination plan, Ms. Hagging indicated that the combination plan is not seeing much use. People are either choosing to elect the traditional plan or the pure defined contribution plan, but a lesser percentage than was initially expected are electing the combination plan. I can tell you just some general observations or comments. One thing I noticed as I looked through materials online, and most of the information, well, I might as well mention my information sources. The way I gathered information was I went online and I was able to look at member handbooks, in some cases employer handbooks, in some cases, actuarial reports, because they were, I could find one, it would summarize the plan benefits for me. And if I couldn't find everything I needed there, I would then try to look in the statutes or laws for these particular states to get some additional details. And in the course of looking through those materials, one thing I did notice is that whenever a state had a defined benefit plan, which individuals didn't have to be in other words, if they had other options, adverse selection against the defined benefit plan was a concern. By adverse selection, what I'm basically talking about is individuals who, because they perhaps don't expect to be in state service that long, would prefer a defined contribution approach because of the portability. You have a lot of individuals who decide that some option other than the defined benefit plan would be better for them. And as a result, the individuals that you have going into the defined benefit plan tend to be those who expect to stay for a longer period of time. And so you don't get as much turnover assumption. You don't get as much benefit from a turnover assumption as you would if the defined benefit program were the only possibility that these individuals had. When individuals leave a defined benefit plan, typically the individuals are able to take out their employee contributions and some portion of their earnings on the employee contributions. But the employer contributions and all the earnings on the employer contributions stay in the defined benefit plan, and they're used to help pay the benefits to those who remain, those who will eventually stay around long enough to draw an annuity. So when you don't have as much turnover as you expect, you don't have those gains to reduce the need for contributions. So that pushes up the contribution requirements. I'm sure it's a concern for all these plans. In some cases, it was very specific. You would see handbooks for employers that these plans had presented to the so they could provide this information to the various employer units out there, and they would contain a statement in their warning that we don't have too much experience with this plan yet. We are concerned that the contribution requirements are going to go up because we don't have a good handle on turnover. So they felt that there was a need to put in print to warn the employer to plan for the possible need for higher contribution rates going into the future. Regarding vesting, vesting varied quite a bit across these plans. Utah had the lowest vesting requirement, at least for retirement annuities. That was 4 years. There were a few others that were 5 years and some that had 10-year vesting. One thing that I was surprised to find, though, was that with some of these plans, the vesting requirement differed depending upon the particular benefit involved. For instance, they would have a vesting requirement for the retirement benefit. But if you became disabled, the question whether or not you could qualify for a disability benefit from the plan, you had to have a certain amount of service, and it might be a lot less than the amount needed to qualify for to vest for a retirement benefit, or in some cases it was more. One of these plans, you had to have at least 15 years of service before you could be eligible for a disability benefit. In some of these plans, the requirement to to have your spouse be eligible to receive an annuity if you died while you were an active employee could be quite lengthy. Again, 10, 15 years. And it was considerably in excess of the vesting for a normal retirement benefit. Regarding accrual rates in these plans, they vary from 1% to 2.2%. And the accrual rate is the percentage of the, well, in some cases it was high five average salary. Some plans were high three, others were high two. It's the percentage of the high five average that you receive per year of service. And again, they vary from 1%, which is quite low, up to 2.2%. The plan that had the 2.2% accrual rate was the traditional plan under the Ohio state system. And again, though, that was a basic plan. So that is a reason for that fairly high accrual rate. Within the combination plans themselves, the accrual rates range from 1%. That was in Georgia. The federal plan was 1.1%. And it ranged up to 1.5% in Oregon and Utah. And 1.5% is fairly generous. The accrual rate, for instance, in MSRS General and Para General is 1.7. So 1.5 in a combination plan where the individuals also had a defined contribution component is relatively generous. Another point, dependent child coverage. I had trouble getting information on this. At times the information was not clear. There were a few plans where they very clearly specified that if an individual dies while active, the dependent children would be entitled to a certain dollar amount per month or an annuity tied to some extent to years of service. But for other plans, I could not find anything. Now, it could be that there is some general provision in some other chapter of the laws of this state dealing with dependent children. So that's one possibility, that they are covered, but simply aren't covered where I was looking. In other cases, it may be that they are expecting that there would be a surviving spouse getting a surviving spouse benefit, and that the benefit that the surviving spouse is receiving would be sufficient for the entire family, the spouse and the remaining children. In other cases, it could be that they simply expect that the state employee is going to cover this through private sector insurance, through life insurance, to make sure that the dependent children have some income in the event of the death of the employee. I mentioned disability earlier, and I was surprised that disability treatment varies considerably. In some cases, you could qualify for disability benefit with very little service. In other cases, you had to have 15 years or more. In some cases, it didn't seem to be covered at all. Perhaps the state is assuming that people are going to take out long-term disability insurance on their own. Or in one case, it appears that there's some sort of disability coverage, but it's not being funded through the retirement plans. With our retirement plans, disability is one of the benefits to which individuals can receive. It's part of the benefit package, and therefore it's built into the funding. You know, we have the normal cost for retirement benefits and disability and so on. It's all built into the funding mechanisms for our plans. But in at least one of these states, it appears that the disability coverage is in some separate program. And I don't know whether the state is self-insuring or whether there is some sort of arrangement where they're simply using some outside insurance company provide some group rate to their employees. I'm not sure, but it certainly did not appear to be covered through the pension plan itself. Last thing I'd like to comment on is inflation matches. With any of the defined contribution plans, given the general nature of those plans, any sort of post-retirement increase was not applicable. I didn't see any that tried to offer one, and I'm not sure just how it would be financed if they did. If the defined contribution plans, you put in your years, and the contributions grow over time, and the investment earnings on those contributions determines the value of the benefit to which you're going to be able to receive. With the defined benefit components, or the pure defined benefit plans, with most of these plans, there was some sort of a cost of living increase. Georgia was the only system that did not appear to provide any increase. The state of Indiana provides ad hoc increases. There's nothing specific stated in their laws stating any specific percentage on any regular basis, but it was clear in various materials that were provided that the legislature periodically decides what is feasible and just and provides increases on an ad hoc basis. Ohio provides a 3% increase, but I've mentioned that's done in a rather peculiar way. It does not compound. Oregon has a 2% inflation match. Utah has a 4% inflation match. Washington has a 3% inflation match. The best system for keeping people whole seemed to be under the federal program. And what the federal plan was is it would match inflation up to 2%. Or if inflation was greater than 2%, what the benefit recipient would receive is an increase equal to the inflation rate minus 1%. So up to 2%, you receive the match. If inflation were, say, 5% in a given year, you would receive 4%. If it were 10%, you would receive 9%. So above 2%, it was the rate of inflation minus 1%. However, I would add that the general level of benefits under that federal plan were very modest. I believe the accrual rate was 1.1%. So it seemed to have the best post-retirement protection, but the benefit was pretty marginal under the defined benefit component. With those comments, I would open up for any questions that you have.
Did you uncover any examples of where the certain, like let's just say for an example, that the first $40,000 of salary would be in a defined contribution, and then above that, an employee would have the option of signing up for a defined contribution?
Mr. Chairman, members, no, I did not. My sample was pretty small.
Yeah.
There's six or seven examples here. I would assume there are examples like that out there. There were not in mine. In the ones included here, if people were in a combination plan, you were in both, and the contributions to the defined benefit component, if there were any, would be based on your entire salary, except for one plan where they had a limit above $200,000. They simply did not include it. So contributions were made on amounts up to $200,000, but there never was a cutoff. The first 40 or 50,000 of your contributions goes to this plan. Anything above that goes to the defined contribution plan. But what I did notice with some of these plans, though, was that with the defined benefit plan, it was entirely financed by the employer. The employee contribution was zero. And all the employee contribution went into the defined contribution component. In other cases, it was a little of each. But there was at least one, maybe more, where the entire employee contribution went into the defined contribution plan, and the employer was funding in its entirety the defined benefit component.
The other example that occurs to me is any situations where, let's say, the standard employee contribution is 5%, where employees would be given the option of making it 7 or 8% with the 2, 3% going into a defined contribution?
Members, certainly within the defined contribution component, I believe there were a few plans. There's got to be at least one, as I'm remembering it. There's got to be more. I suspect there's more than that. Where the employee contribution to the defined contribution component was variable. It might be stated as a minimum. The employee had to put a minimum of 1% in, but the employee could put a greater percentage up to whatever limits would be consistent with federal requirements. And there was one plan, and frankly, it's coming back to me now. There was one plan that...
Remember, already is Mr. Chairman. I mean, generation.
Yeah.
There was one plan where it was structured quite unusually. I don't know why they would want to do this, but the employee had to... There were several contribution rates which the employee could elect. 5%, 7%, 10%, up to 15%, which the employee could elect. But the way it was currently set up in the law, when the person enters that plan, they have to choose which contribution they want to put in. And it struck me as an arrangement that could cause problems down the line. Some sort of change in life circumstances where an individual might want more for other things other than putting it into the defined contribution plan, and they didn't have the flexibility to reduce the contribution. If they, for instance, said, I'm going to put 15% of my salary into this plan, so they want to buy a house or medical bills or whatever down the line, they did not have the option under law of modifying that. And I'm not sure why the state would want to do that, but there was at least one that did.
Representative Klein?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things I was struck here is that the several times it was mentioned that under the defined contribution plan that they could do a annuity. And other times it was not mentioned. So I was wondering, is it that because at any point under the defined contribution plan, you could take those dollars accrued and convert them into a similar defined benefit plan, if you might want to call that, just by converting it to an annuity, and then you would have that for the rest of your life in whatever way you want to set it up. But by looking through some of these defined contribution plans or member directed, that there is this something that in order to do to annuitize those savings and to do it from a state level would have to be authorized in statute. I think in Minnesota we have that you can convert those savings, or is that something that is only done by the individual taking their cash accrued and then converting it into an annuity, but doing it through any one of the other entities outside of the state government pension system? So I wasn't quite sure.
Mr. Chairman, members, where I had specifics, I put them in here. Generally, there was very little said about the defined contribution components of these plans. In some cases, it was specifically stated that if you wanted to take the value of your account when you retire, if you want to take the value of your account, it was specifically stated in their laws that you did have the right to essentially turn that over to the organization that was running the defined benefit plan and providing annuities on retirement. You had the right to turn it over to that organization, say, okay, annuitize it and pay me monthly benefits for life. In other cases, there was nothing mentioned at all, and therefore I would leave it blank. What I suspect is going on in a lot of these cases is that they did not have the right to turn it over to the state organization running the defined benefit plan and annuitize it. You could take the account value out, turn it over to an insurance company and have an annuity provided that way. But there was nothing stating that you could do it within the state program.
So it sounds like, Mr. Chairman, that if there were anything like that, it would just be one of those issues to be clarified. But the other thing I was thinking of, Mr. Chairman, was that we were looking at a... because I think there's a lot of discussion nationally right now. I know there are things actually passed into statute, but I've talked to some Utah legislators, and they have further ideas of what they're thinking of doing, because you get history and practice, and some things are, especially with the economy, the way it is. So I think there's a lot of things in the works that may not be an actual statute, but what you did was what was actually passed in statute and functioning already. But I was wondering, I know Mr. Bergstrom was going to do give us a little bit of an update on the Roth 457, and the reason why is that adds something to our state retirement system and is something important for us to consider. Maybe that's planned for tomorrow, but I didn't necessarily see it here, though I may have missed it on the agenda, but I would really appreciate if we might be able to hear an update on that.
It's not on the agenda for tomorrow, but it's one of those things that we could add to the November agenda.
Okay.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kiffmeyer, it is on our interim topics, on our minutes.
I voted for
it. You did. But I guess my question...
It's
on our list. I think it's discussed.
It hasn't been scheduled yet.
And as usual, Mr. Burke did a great job with this. I guess my question is, piece of information that I would find interesting is how long these states have been in this hybrid, how long they've had these in statute. And as Ms. Hacking was saying, that there hasn't been much participation in the hybrid level or the defined contribution side of it. And for what reason? I'd like to know the outcomes of this. It's nice to see the differences between the DC and DB and the hybrid, but is it working? I mean,
Ms. Hacking?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, Laurie Hacking with TRA. Basically, the participation rates are these. 95% of the current participants are in the traditional plan. 4% have selected the roughly member-directed defined contribution plan, and only 1% the combination plan. Even though financially, when you look at it, when we actually designed this back in 2000, if you look at the underlying numbers, the combination or the hybrid plan, it should be the most attractive financially. But we found that people weren't picking it because it's complicated and very hard to understand and hard to counsel people. So people tended to just gravitate, you know, to the pure defined contribution plan because it's easy to understand. It's their contributions. They know where it's going to go, and they were perhaps more interested in taking the risk involved with that and maybe felt they were shorter term. But it's basically 95% in the defined benefit plan, 4% in the pure DC, and 1% hybrid.
Mr. Chairman, I have another question.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Ms. Hocking, can you tell me what the default is? In other words, when you have a new employee and they have a choice like this, which plan is the default if they don't say?
Currently, the default is the traditional defined benefit plan. And that was done very consciously for legal reasons and others, you know, just because that's the most conservative. If people aren't actively choosing and you have to put them into something, you know, the legal advice was that we needed to put them into the plan that was the most, in a sense, safe and conservative if they weren't making a conscious choice. We did very carefully talk about defaults, and, you know, that was very thoroughly vetted. So it's an important issue.
Just a little follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Hacking, also on the default, do you have, you know, when you say 95% went in the traditional, what percent of that 95 was default and what was a conscious choice to do the traditional plan?
I don't have that, but I could get it.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Fogelman,
you're talking about the Ohio situation.
Yes, I'm sorry.
When you say that based on the numbers, the combination plan should be preferred, why is it? I'm frankly having a hard time kind of getting my head around this. Why would that be better for someone starting their career for the state of Ohio?
It really has to. Mr. Chair, Senator.
And I'm talking about the major components of the flexibility mm-hmm. versus the specifics of the plan. What is it that, why one should think about something like this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pogomiller, the Ohio plans are very complicated because health care is involved. And there's a very significant contribution made to the health care plan that the employer only makes. And that contribution can range from as high as 5.5, and it actually varies from year to year depending upon actuarial experience. And if you can imagine trying to forward fund a health care plan and predicting health care costs, it's very difficult. So long story short, it's because of the way the healthcare component works within the combination plan versus the defined contribution plan that really the combo plan should be attractive. But again, it's complicated and very hard to counsel people.
Mr.
Sir,
and so if an employee had enough information, or let's say you had the perfect employee knowledge, perfect knowledge, and they did then start to move, the people who would do better move to the combo plan, would it still be less expensive for the state, the overall system, or would this drive up costs for the state?
Actually, it's cost neutral.
Okay.
It was designed from the state's perspective that really it didn't matter which plan they went into, because the contribution on the employer's part would be the same, 14%.
So then how does the employee do better in some circumstances?
Because of the health care component. And also, it's a matter, you know, if you're a new employee, you don't know whether you're going to vest or not. And trying to ferret out, and that's really why, if you don't know you're going to vest, really the combination plan is the better choice. And I should add here, the other complicating factor is in Ohio they can switch after the first 5 years, if you're in one plan or another, you can switch to the other plan. After 10 years, you can make another switch, and after that, there's a lifetime option to switch. When you switch, however, it has to be cost neutral. So if you're in the defined contribution plan, if you started with that and you decide after 5 years, I want to go into the DB, it's only whatever is in your account can buy you in terms of years of service that you get. If you did really well, then you can buy those years of service and you have something left over. So it's just very complicated. I would not recommend it. I mean, there's some elements that are, I think are useful for your discussion and for your design approach, but it's a complicated system, and a lot of it comes from the healthcare element. There was a question about Medicare before. In fact, Ohio has a lot of people who are pre-86 hires for whom the state's healthcare system is the only thing they have. They have no Medicare. It has, you know, a lot of people in that category. So that's another pretty messy.
Mr. Chairman? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that getting a sampling of other states' plans can be very helpful. It helps you to take a look at it. But the one danger we have here is that I don't think anybody's suggesting that in Minnesota, if we did something like this, we would take an Ohio or all that involves. So I think we ought to enjoy the discussion, and I think it's really fascinating and interesting to hear. But I think because it's only pension being involved here, the actual pension components similar to Minnesota are the ones that are really relevant to us. And I think as soon as you get into complexity, because it has health care, which we would not do, I think that makes a difference into how we take a look at some of these other options. Have to be careful of statements like it's complicated when it's complicated because it has something we don't do.
Senator Chamberlain?
This is supposed to be cost neutral, and presumably it was created to give some benefit to the employee, the hybrid piece. What about the administrative costs? I mean, it's got to be. She's shaking her head. It's going to be bad.
Mr. Chair, Senator, it was extremely expensive. We spent millions and millions of dollars to implement this because of the programming involved, and you know, it meant a total rewrite of our information systems. Having to beef up staff to counsel people and help them make investment decisions, you know, which would be new. So it is very expensive, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Ms. Hacking, I don't know if you have a ballpark figure, but say someone worked in the system and had the traditional plan and they worked for 35 years. What would their annual pension be then?
Ms. Hagee?
Mr. Chair,
the average public employee salary.
Yeah, I'm rusty on these numbers, but basically the formula is 2.2% for every year, 2.2% of salary for every year of service. And if you are over, Mr. Burek had this outlined pretty well on his memo, page 4.
Okay.
At over 30 years of service, you said somebody who's 30 or 35 years of service, but if you worked over 30 years of service, then the full rate jumped up to 2.5. So I don't have a calculator with me, but...
Well, you have taught, Mr. Chair, Ms. Hacking, you have taught me that it's the three-legged stool with your own Social Security, with your pension, and with your savings.
Mm-hmm.
Does the average person in Ohio on this traditional plan have enough money so that you only need a two-legged stool? Or does the traditional plan make up for two of the legs and then their own savings the other third?
Mr. Chair, it is in Ohio PERS case there are only two legs to the stool. That's correct. People are encouraged to participate voluntarily in a deferred compensation plan, just like we have here in Minnesota, you know, to give some private savings
in addition to the combination plan or right. The traditional plan.
Yes. There is some voluntary participation in deferred compensation. I'd say probably lower rates than what we achieve here in Minnesota, though. So, lower rates of participation. But you are accurate. In Ohio, this is their only pension coverage. They don't have Social Security unless they happen to have a spouse who works in Social Security covered employment, or if they had some moonlighting or an extra job that they accumulated some credits.
Just one more question then, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Hagen, then. Does the defined contribution component, is that invested by the State Investment Board along with the money that's in the traditional plan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, it is... The individual has choices to make among a myriad of investment funds, some of which are run by the state. Some of them are brand names like Vanguard. But it's the individual who makes a choice about what they're going to put into stocks or bonds and what funds. But we were very careful to offer state investment funds because they're so much cheaper and you know, made them attractive, and my understanding is they are, you know, attractive. So
thank you, Mr. Chair.
We want to give the people who've asked to be able to speak to us to speak before we adjourn here shortly, but let me this whole issue of a potential hybrid is clearly one that we need to have further discussion about and come to some kind of resolution as we finish up our meetings here. But from my standpoint, we've heard so far a clear preference on the part of many employees to continue a defined benefit program because of the security, and from the state's perspective, it costs less to administer. We need to keep in mind, however, the potential benefits to the employee for some defined contribution element here, including the ability to make some decisions about how much risk they're willing to take, to give employees the opportunity to take their money out should they leave employment and move it someplace else, invest it someplace else, whatever the case might be. Those are pretty significant opportunities for employees to get more engaged, more involved, more responsibility for their own retirement. And so I think that's a reason why we need to keep thinking in terms of some kind of hybrid opportunity for the benefit of the employees. Now, the thing that's unclear is what are the potential savings, if any, for the state, reducing state risk down the road. And that's an issue that we need to sort out as well. So I just offer that as kind of a review of some of the issues that we need to wrestle with here. We've had Pat Anderson is not here, but Kim Crockett, do you wish to speak at this point, Kim? Welcome.
Thank you. Picking up on that theme, Mr. Chair, Kim Crockett with the Minnesota Free Market Institute, I was trying to think of what I could add to the Commission's meetings this month, and wanted to just mention two kind of overarching policy issues. One is balancing all the stakeholder interests, the state as an employer, state employees, and then the taxpayer as we define what retirement security is for state employees. And the other is the overarching policy discussion about designing a vital 21st century state workforce. So whether pensions are fully funded sometime in the future or underfunded as they are right now, you know, we're watching this national conversation going on, this big debate between, you know, is it a trillion, is it 3 trillion? I don't know. I'm not an economist and don't want to pretend to be one. But, you know, so whether we're funded or unfunded and at what level, I think that the pension system that we have here in Minnesota ought to balance the retirement needs of state employees, the state as both the employer, but also the state as the provider of core government services, and all of that against the risk that taxpayers have to fund all of these things. And they have the responsibility for footing the bill. So it's a tricky balancing that you guys have to do. And I also want to throw in that, picking up on your theme, Chairman, is that state employees are diverse in their needs and their preferences. They're young and old, they're short-term employees, they're long-term career employees. Some are risk-averse, some are interested in the upswing of markets and interested in that and want to participate in the upside of markets that we all hope to see again in the near future. So I just wanted to say that at the Minnesota Free Market Institute, we agree with the theme raised by the Minnesota Taxpayers Association and Mark Havanen last month in challenging the assumption that the state should be providing that 85% pre-retirement income so that retirees can maintain their pre-retirement standard of living, whether that's based on a high five or some other formula. We want to question that assumption. It's a standard goal for all of us in our retirement, but how state employees get there might be different than somebody in the private marketplace. We view it as an unfair risk and burden on taxpayers and want to remind ourselves that state employees are also taxpayers. We feel that it ignores a common sense understanding that when we reach retirement, if we've managed our lives properly, we have reduced living expenses. And if you look at various studies, including the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the annual expenditures for seniors over 65 drops about 28% from the 55 to 64-year-old pre-retirement group and 36% from the 45 to 54-year-old age group. So, you know, to assume a pre-retirement income level of 85% or more is a very generous standard, and we question whether the state of Minnesota ought to be guaranteeing that through a defined benefit system. So as you go through your inquiry as to what may be next, we would ask that you look at how do you define what's an adequate retirement security coming from the state and whatever defined benefit system might be there. And the second issue is the current pension approach also deprives state employees of flexibility in their careers and investment choices. The modern workforce today is very mobile. People change jobs approximately 10 times, for better or for worse, and change actual careers 3 or 4 times. So we would encourage you to design workforce policies that attract and retain the best talent from Minnesota while allowing people to enter and exit public employment and to get away from the career public servant who may just stay in the job in order to protect her retirement nest egg. Is there some other way to do that for her so that she gets the benefit of her contributions and the state contributions to her retirement, whether she stays for, you know, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, and to get away from that model? Because I think that the private sector and the public sector will both benefit from the different skill sets and perspectives that those employees will bring. And maybe that's where some of the savings comes. I don't know. But if you have a different kind of workforce that looks at how to solve state problems and how to deliver services, the price tag of government could go down there. I don't know how you measure that, but I suspect that might be a result. So that requires a shift away from the current pension rules that penalize people who don't make state service a long-term career. And just quickly, in case we don't get to it tomorrow, there's an agenda item 7, and I haven't had a chance to speak to Mary Vanek about it or hear her testimony, but it's my understanding that the part of the omnibus bill in 2010 changed the deferred interest rate for para members who leave government service, and it dropped down to 1%, so that the value of those employees who've left state service is significantly eroded over time. And that's just an example, I think, of where policies need to change to encourage that type of workforce mobility rather than penalize it in the area of pensions. I think we all know employees who are maybe just sitting on that nest egg rather than retiring or moving on to other careers because of the penalties involved. And that may be just one more example of where the policy needs to change. So in addition to reviewing the current assumptions about the 8.5% assumed rate of return, I think it makes sense for the state of Minnesota to move away from the traditional defined benefit pension system. And maybe the challenges that the private sector has experienced with behavioral, let me just put it this way, people don't always save when they should. They don't always save when we want them to. Maybe the challenges that the private sector has experienced as it's moved away from a pension system over the last 20 years or so can inform state legislators here in Minnesota as we try to define, a better mousetrap. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Members, we'll be back at it again at 9 o'clock in the morning, and please come prepared to make some decisions about what topics we want to address in November. We're adjourned. Yeah.